Devil's Knowing.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is the first hour of episode 592.5. Jason Lindgren is with me, and Chris Groves joins us for the first time. And by the way, this gentleman helped us reacquire, well, I shouldn't say reacquire, because the first time I went to acquire it, I announced the same day I was going to do it on air, and someone else snatched crow777.com and made a mockery out of that for, I don't even know, years anyhow. Took money from people under false pretenses, and a number of times we tried to get the domain back, and with no luck. And finally, Chris here got a hold of it. So a big thank you to Chris for that. But anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a hot and pretty lovely good day.
Well, I think we're about to get the remnants of a hurricane here at the end of the week. But let's get back on point here. We're about to cover systems and vehicles. For those who haven't really paid attention, it's getting to be a thing, man. There's a lot of videos out there of people walking up and basically just reprogramming and taking vehicles, among other things. I don't think many people are aware of the sheer amount of data their vehicles is taking on them, particularly if they're newer than, say, 2017, 2018, something like that. To include, if you ever Bluetooth into your vehicle, they are downloading everything they can get off your phone, to include contacts and texts, all of it. But we're going to focus in a little bit more, and I'm going to let Chris explain it to you. So with that, welcome, Chris.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. Pleasure to be here. And yeah, it's just nice to finally talk to everybody. So I guess I can jump in. I'll do a quick introduction. Again, my name's Chris Groves. And actually, as of now, I used to be with a company called Coalfire, and it was one of the largest pen testing firms in the basically in the industry. As of March of this year, I'm no longer with them. I still have a lot of friends there, and I still have my connections with them, but I very much appreciate all the opportunities that they gave me. And really what I'd like to do is just jump into kind of my background, because again, I think it's kind of relevant real quick. So when I first jumped into the industry, I was doing a lot of IT, network admin, system administration, that type of work. I did that for about a decade outside of college. And then when I got burned out from that, I realized it's like IT. It's like anything. You hit that ceiling and you can't go anywhere further. This was back in 2012, where I realized that there's a whole new industry coming. And at the time, it wasn't really called cybersecurity, information security, anything like that, because it just was at its fledgling. They didn't have college courses or anything like that for it. And so I took a pretty dramatic pay cut at the time and decided that I'm gonna jump into this new industry. And that's where I got introduced to hacking all the things, really, eventually. I actually took my first baby steps in it. I was actually a security auditor to begin with. So I think, Crow, you're familiar with the payment card industry and having a QSA audit to some degree, unless you're probably not doing like the one where you have to hire a third party to do it. You're probably doing a self-questionnaire. But anytime you want to accept payment card data, use credit cards, there's this annual audit you have to go through, and it keeps getting more expensive. So that's kind of where I got my feet wet. And then because of my technical background, I actually was introduced to the other department, which was the hacking team, right? I was employee number 127 at the company. And the hackers were, I think the department itself was maybe five people at the time. And so I was in this kind of sweet spot where I was doing work across both teams, basically. So I was doing PCI assessments and security audits and that type of thing. And then on the other side, I was also in between projects. I was getting introduced to how to hack things and break into networks and do that sort of deal. So it was a great opportunity and a lot of fun. And then by the time I left, we had about 150 testers. My own team underneath me, I had probably 20 some odd people that I was responsible for across our accounts. And a lot of the work that we were doing, again, think of a lot of application testing, network testing, mobile testing, automobile testing, hardware, IoT, all that stuff. And so just because of having that access into all these environments, it's very eye-opening, right? And at the same time, it's very jarring, where you're like, I shouldn't be on the internet anymore. Like when I'm done, it's like, I don't want anything to do with it, that sort of thing. But at the same time, it's definitely helped pay the bills and help my family with having at least some level of comfort.
So do you have a background, Chris, as a code guy?
I do not, actually. Yeah. And so that's one thing that's interesting with the industry, right? And I think that's where what I've been lucky with it is, again, my background was never a developer. I never did code. Even to this day, like I can typically figure it out. Like I understand the logic and the application logic of what's usually being written, but for the life of me, like I'm just not a code guy. Like I'm just not. and I'll figure it out. I can do it and I can modify code and change it as what I need to. But I've never been that type of guy that can just go and write a giant thing from scratch. It's just never been in my mindset.
What types of systems did they have you hacking?
It's typically anything that's off the shelf for the most part. So a lot of it's Linux, different flavors of Linux. A lot of it is going to be Windows, right? And a lot of what you're really abusing is think of just that interconnectivity with anything. Like 9 times out of 10, you're not so much abusing, oh yeah, I'm going to go write some ODE and it's going to be, I'm abusing the source code. And every once in a while you'll get lucky where you can figure something like that out. But a lot of times you're abusing the implementation of it because there's so many things that people are trying to get right. And again, coming from an IT background, often you're under budget, you're understaffed, you're pushed. We needed this last week. And security is kind of the last thing on your mind. It's like, oh, I just got to get this out and then I'll fix it or I'll harden it later where I'll go and turn off all the things that we don't actually need. And a lot of times that's really what you're abusing. And that's usually the best stories to tell. But I mean, everybody has in their mind, like, again, I think of all the old hacker movies, like Hackers or Swordfish or, I mean, you name it, right? Or CSI, right? you see a hacking screen and it's just goofy, right? It's like a cartoon or whatever it is. And it's not like that, right? 9 times out of 10 or even 99 out of 100 times, you're failing and it's boring. You're looking at a terminal, you're looking at just a blip on the thing. And once you get it, you're like, oh man, I got root or I got different privileges or I got it to behave in some way that it's not supposed to. That's just like the start of the journey. That's the start of that rabbit hole to go down. And it really is just, it's very interesting. And I think one of the most discouraging things that I was experiencing was, again, it's very different from like a smaller shop or even like a medium-sized shop. When you start getting into like the enterprise grade clients, you're just not finding stuff. You don't find, I mean, you find issues, but 9 times out of 10, they either know about it and they don't care about it, or you haven't done your due diligence to demonstrate that impact. And it's always by the numbers. It's like, okay, well, how many people are actually affected by this and what type of data or what's the value on the return? What's the actual impact? Like, what are you actually doing that hurts our reputation or whatever it might be?
So let me jump in here. I want to focus in on penetration testing for vehicles, but I want to ask you one question before we start to define what penetration testing is, particularly vis-a-vis automobiles. But I have a friend who's like gets hired by some of the biggest boys on the planet to do basically what could be termed hacking. Supposedly white hat hacking. But the other night I was talking with him and I was still of a mind that like Mac was way safer than say Windows. And he says, it's just not true. Do you get a sense of what the most vulnerable platforms out there are? Or do you feel like they're kind of all on the table now?
I would say it's pretty equal opportunity. Linux in general is still probably the most obscure just because there's so many different flavors of it. But again, because a lot of the underlying code base is similar, often if you can find a vulnerability in one, it'll still kind of transverse across the different flavors. So it's pretty much equal opportunity out there. And from my mind, it's always about market share, right? Hackers are lazy by general. So it's more of what can they get out of it? And if there's not enough people using the platform, then they probably don't need to spend their time doing it.
Plan the odds. All right, let's jump in here. So what is penetration testing? What is it? How do you define penetration testing?
So a penetration test is basically a simulated cyber attack against either infrastructure or it's typically infrastructure, but it's where you're specifically checking for weaknesses or vulnerabilities to actually help gain insight on, is this something that we actually have to care about or actually have to fix? And it's typically controlled in a lot of times the base layer is going to become kind of compliance driven, where again, let's say you have like a HIPAA regulation or again, PCI or some automotive standard, you're going to have some driver for that action. And typically with a lot of these tests, it's required to be done on a recurring basis. So let's say every 12 months, they have to go back and retest that piece. And then typically there's tons of frameworks out there. So for example, there's one called the Penetration Testing Execution Standard, that's PTES. There's PCI DSS, there's FedRAMP if people are trying to bring their product or service into like federal agencies, specifically for the US. There's also ISO, there's SOC for any of that stuff. HIPAA Tiber EU is a new one that's going to be coming out over the EU.
Do people even give a damn about HIPAA anymore? When I first started way back in the day making websites and stuff like that, HIPAA was a big damn deal. Everyone was afraid of violating it. Fast forward 10, 15 years, and it just seemed like nobody cared anymore. They were taking data and doing whatever they wanted with it. Do you feel like people are still even worried about HIPAA?
I typically only see HIPAA type testing is when it's either a hospital or something directly in the medical industry. Outside of it, you don't really see it as much. It's not to say that people don't do it, but a lot of the thing with how these frameworks overlap. So for example, if you're doing an annual pen test for X, it's probably going to carry over and also cover that requirement for Y. So as long as, again, the scope is adequately covered and the scope is essentially what you're targeting. And again, for like hospitals and all those things, it's fairly common where they're still doing kind of annual tests for those requirements.
Well, by definition, data collection grabs everything. That was where I first got my eyes opened, was when it was when data collection had started happening big time, like 98, 99, but nobody knew about it. It's about the time Sun Microsystems came out and said, guess what? Privacy is dead, and nobody believed him. And he was right. It was. But what they were doing was grabbing data before the rules changed, which they still kind of haven't changed. But my point is, they went in and they scraped everything. The medical records, doctor visits, your credit card, whatever you do at the pharmacy, all of it was getting scraped. And so it seems like there's a double standard where we're testing, like you're talking about, penetration to stop the so-called bad guys. But there's an echelon above that. Even the people who make, say, a app on your phone, they're collecting everything they can off that. As a matter of fact, we launched a Crow 777 app and people started complaining because of the data collection. So I contacted the maker and said, turn this off, knock it off. And they said, we will if you pay us. So I'm kind of just making the point.
No, it's a shadow business, really. Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean,
it's us and them. We supposedly have rules, but they're taking it all regardless.
Yeah. And again, think of the pen test itself. In many ways, you're kind of doing it with your hands tied behind your back, right? So you follow all these rules. You're allowed to test this. You can't look at this. If you do this, it's blah, blah, blah. You know, you have all these rules that you're supposed to be following and adhere to with like clear start and stop times and all those different pieces. But at the same time, I can think of thousands of examples where we might find something and it was technically out of scope. And I don't want to say it's forgotten about, but it's definitely not the priority. They definitely don't have the same reaction to it where it's like, oh yeah, that's this other thing that we don't have to care about. And you can make the argument that, well, you probably should care about it because it's obviously connected to what we're testing. But again, it's very much a weird politics game of trying to do the best that you can in the time that you're provided and doing what you can with it to try to have that impact and actually feel like you're doing something helpful for the community. If I'm using this product, which a lot of times I either was or I know who the company that is, I'm doing it for the end user. I'm doing it for everybody else that's involved with it because that's really where it pays off, at least where you feel like you're doing something valuable, if that makes any sense.
So let me focus this in here. I want to try to make it a little compelling for the end user. Let's talk about vehicles because I'm sure people have seen the bad guys drive up in the driveway and within minutes take control of a vehicle. Let's talk about where are the weak points for people driving those new vehicles? Since you've done the penetration testing, I'm guessing that you're pretty aware of where the average person is at risk. And after that, let's talk about what steps can be taken to try to make yourself more secure. Because like on my car, I got to the point on my car where I almost wish I would have quit trading cars in 2016.
This makes me think of Teslas and how the car is pretty much just one great big computer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One thing to keep in mind, let me jump into like the overview. So that's also important to understand why there's so many issues to some extent. So when you think of all the technology that's in your vehicle today, there's actually a great book out there by Alyssa Knight, and she actually put out a book called Hacking Connected Cars. It's a little bit old now, but at the same time, it's a great primer. It's free to read. Everybody can go check it out. I'll put that in the notes essentially. But what she kind of outlined in there is really where I got a lot of my overview from because I couldn't write it any better. But again, when you think of the different technologies that are inside your vehicle, it's not new technology. Again, think of old networks, right? Where they're stitching together all these old things just to make it work. And it's no different in cars. So for example, you can look at, they call it like the controller area network, which is the CAN. That was created in 1983. And so it was the first bus standard in vehicle networks. And it was developed for communication mechanisms to address the need. So think of, again, like a traditional network, but it's connecting all of these devices together. So think of like your suspension or your ABS or your instrument panel, your seat position, your transmission, all those things, all those different controller units are essentially on the same network. So unlike a traditional network where everybody believes that, okay, I've got to log in, you've got to put in some sort of credentials. Once you're actually on that network, it's essentially a flat network, meaning that anything can communicate with anything. And that's where a lot of the vulnerabilities come in, because there's no recheck and there's really no validation of like, hey, I'm the front headlight. I need to go and unlock the door, because the receiver that receives those transmissions, there's no way to block that and protect that.
So basically what you're saying is someone with the right command can take control of any given system, unlock the doors.
Yeah, essentially, as long as they're plugged into the proper CAN network. So there's a great example of a RAV4. In modern terms, they call it CAN injection. And so that's essentially where you'll see, you can find videos of it on the web, right? So essentially what happens, and the RAV4 was a big example because the front headlight was also connected on the same network as the locking system, right? Or the door locks, essentially. And so you'd see criminals, they would basically go and pop off the bumper and then basically splice the cable from the headlight. I think it was like the front left headlight right near the driver's side. They pop it off, connect their little device to it, and it goes and floods that message that says, hey, car, unlock the door, unlock the door, unlock the door. And then eventually, within a couple of seconds, the receiver will get that message and it'll unlock the doors, and then the thieves will hop in and drive off.
So they're basically removing a headlight. It sounds like it takes a couple minutes. So they have to have time to pop a headlight, tap in, right?
Yep. And sometimes they have to pry off like the bumper.
Jeez.
The CAN injection is kind of the more modern version of like all the key fob attacks from back in the day. But the CAN injection is kind of the big thing right now, just because it's relatively easy to do, but they have to find vehicles that are, again, you can go and look up how they're blueprinted, right? How the CAN networks are laid out on that car, and they'll specifically target the vehicles that are vulnerable to that. Because again, it's going to be different than, let's say, if like the rear back headlight is different, or side door handle has this, where they actually have to drill a hole in the door. They typically are going to go for the easier cars that can do that.
Is this sort of thing an oversight by the manufacturers?
It is on the manufacturer. So the problem with the CAN injection in general is that it's kind of an industry known problem right now. And really the only good news is that it's actually a software fix. So it's something that can be fixed, but logistically, all the car brands are susceptible to it. And all the car brands are kind of coming up with their little solutions to fix it. And hopefully, eventually, it'll become a standard where it actually gets fixed, right? But it's very much a keep crossing your fingers that there's a system update or something that'll fix it for you.
From what you just said, it sounded like you were saying the key fob attack, which I think is what I was talking about, all those videos we used to see. Is that a thing of the past? Is that still current?
So I kind of clump these together, right? So if you think of the key fob, right? So the key fob is the older version of how I define this vulnerability, right? So if you think of the remote keyless entries, that's basically a relay attack. So what'll happen is wherever people are placing their key fob, usually it's by the front door, maybe it's, heaven forbid, it's by a window right near the front door, you know, something like that. But typically what would happen is you typically would need two people. But so picture you have one person with their equipment where they're essentially taking that signal that the key fob is relaying off. And then the person is right near the car and they're basically bouncing that signal back to the car and it'll unlock the car. Think of it like an amplification attack to some extent, where you're essentially just taking the known good signal from that key fob and it'll go and unlock the door.
That seems like a very easy thing to deal with, which is good information. You just put your key fob in a Faraday box, put it in something metal.
Yeah, you essentially put it in a pouch. Gosh, I can't remember the car brand, but I could have sworn there was an old commercial from like the early 2000s where people were like, oh, put your key fob in the refrigerator or put it in the freezer and it'll block the signal. But I can't remember that one. But essentially, yeah, you're trying to block that signal. Many times, rule of thumb is if you're not going to use it, just turn it off, take out the batteries. What's funny, like on my Mazda, for example, I have a little key fob in there and I can take out the batteries. And as long as it's close enough, because all the batteries are doing is making it an amplified signal, right? So it's within a couple feet of the car. But if you take out the batteries, you can still often use it to unlock your door or start the engine. You just have to hold it up right next to it. But definitely the Faraday pouch is probably the best way to go.
Are there other ways besides basically amplifying the key fob signal? There's another way, and it seems like it might be different, where a group of guys come up and a guy's got his device, he's right by the car. Is there another way to do the access by cloning or hacking the signal in some way, or is the key fob the main game?
The key fob's the main way. Again, when you think of that, your car itself is always giving off all sorts of signals, right? All sorts of things. And there is an attack where you can essentially, let's say you're amplifying that message where it's kind of like a check for the key fob, and you're intercepting that and then playing it back. And then by playing it back, you can modify that and basically say, hey, it's found, like this is the key fob. But a lot of those attacks, both the key fob and really any of the relay attacks or the amplification attacks, a lot of the manufacturers more recently, they're actually putting protections in place where it has like a, think of like a signature. It essentially has a signature on that signal. So if anybody modifies it or tries to relay it, it can tell that it's not the original source and it don't work anymore. And I want to say that started going, I want to say that was 2019, 2020-ish when the car brand started pushing that out. So that's kind of what started downplaying a lot of the impact on the key fob attacks, just because it's just not as susceptible anymore. Now, granted, if you have an older car, I'd say anywhere between, geez, like 2021 to 2012, 2015-ish, yeah, you're still probably susceptible. I mean, honestly, a Faraday, a little pouch, you know, they're not very expensive. They're kind of just peace of mind. I like to keep my stuff in that, or I just take out the battery.
I do that for my wallet, for my cards, because people can walk right next to you and scan your cards.
Yeah, they can clone your cards. They can clone your signals, your ID cards, all that same stuff. And all you need is a couple seconds with a little cloner in your pocket to copy that stuff. So
do you feel like the key fob is like for the average person that drives up, has to park their car in a driveway that's not so close to where they are, is the key fob the primary concern for people lifting cars these days? That's the main game in town that they like?
Yeah, definitely. That's still the main game. And that hardware that you can buy, I mean, it's again, it's relatively cheap. It's, I think it's under $20 that you can get. That's still the main game in town when people are doing it.
You know, it's crazy to me to think about what you were talking about. So there's known defects in these systems. When I take my car in, there are, and I'm not even kidding you here, I accidentally said, well, maybe not accidentally, because I was being common sense, I referred to them as mechanics. And the guy said, well, there's
they're no engineers.
More he said, there's right. No more mechanics here. I said, what are you talking about? They're all out there. And I look out there, they're all in white, not like lab coats, but not far off it. He said, they're technicians. And I got to talking with him and I said, well, that's just semantics. And he said, no, not really. He said, haven't you noticed that when a modern car gets damaged at a certain level where it's clearly could be fixed and it gets totaled anyhow? He said, in the car you have, there are 36 computers. If one of those 36 computers gets a fender bender on it and gets damaged, they will try to total it. And so I said, well, wait a minute. If I broke this, that, or the other thing, I could come in and fix. They don't, the dealers that people take their cars, they don't fix cars like they used to, is what I'm getting at. But the first thing they do when you come in is they plug you into the machine and you just get updates. So how could it possibly be that any known coding issue isn't pretty readily dealt with in the update? But what I really wanted to ask you is, does the technician at the dealership, when he's pumping the updates into your car, have really any control over what's going in? Or is it just a packet that he's stuffing down the pipe?
I'm pretty much convinced it's really just, they're not really doing much. They're running their diagnostics and then reporting back. They're not taught how to do that stuff because they're not an engineer.
So it's just a packet.
It's a different skill set. Yeah. Yeah. It's just a system update that you put in. And some car brands, they even just do them over the air. They have over the air updates. So you don't even have to take it to the dealership anymore. It's a different game altogether. So
the reason I even brought this up is because of the kill switch legislation. So you know damn well, if you've got a modern car, one of these days when you go in, they're going to load a kill switch into your car. And that's why I was asking how much control they have, because I was thinking, man, maybe you could bribe the tech or something and not get loaded with a kill switch.
Yeah, they're in there. I mean, they've really, again, if you think of like what they call like the fleet networks, right? So a fleet network in any internet connected car is essentially part of that manufacturer's fleet, and it's every car, right? So again, this is a great topic that Alyssa Knight did a DEF CON talk. I don't know if you've ever heard of DEF CON, but it's basically a hacker conference out in Vegas every year. And around 2015, they actually have a car hacking village, right? So you can actually go there for the weekend. Usually Tesla's there, any other big brands. They always bring a car that people can just go and hack and poke around with kind of thing. It's usually like a stripped down version, or it's just something, you know, so that people can go and play with it. But it's still pretty fun. But they have some pretty good talks just from that conference that are all on YouTube that you can go watch, where it gets into the actual hacking of the fleet connected cars. Back in 2012, and probably a little bit later for us, we had a couple customers where we were doing the car hacking. And it was funny because they wouldn't, obviously we wouldn't have a car delivered to us. It was essentially like your dashboard, like your center dash, the center console. It was always dropped off to one of the offices, and you only have maybe two or three testers that are doing it, but it became like hacker summer camp where everybody that was in Colorado at the time, or people would fly into Colorado, where everybody's just tearing apart this thing and trying to play with it, because it's, again, you're trying to prove all these concepts that, oh yeah, I can turn off the engine, or oh yeah, I can do this, I can do that. And you could, and that was what was terrifying about it. And this was, again, back in 2012, where, again, it's not something that you can go and figure out right away. There's a lot of trial and error and a whole lot of failures. But once you get plugged into the right spot and you're sending the right commands and figuring it out, you're unlocking doors, you're turning off and on the engine, you're doing all these things. But the big thing that's also to be aware of is just a lot of the news that's out there. When you read, oh yeah, this Tesla got hacked or this car got hacked, when you actually read the fine print, it's not something that's typically happening in the wild. I mean, the key fob and the CAN injection, those two type of attacks are the ones that are basically happening in the wild. But a lot of these other attacks were, oh yeah, we turned off the engine and we did this other stuff. And all that stuff is typically done by security researchers, and they're done on behalf of those companies. And they kind of put it out as the sensational news, but I'm honestly not convinced that it's this widespread thing that's happening. And I think that's the one caveat, is that it's really hard to do. It's not this easy thing that everybody's doing. And heaven forbid, if it ever gets to that point, then we'll be in a lot of trouble. But for at least right now, you at least need to have some know-how to actually cause that sort of impact.
Do you have a newer car, Chris, if you don't mind me asking?
I have two. My newer car is probably 2016 or so, and it has probably way too many computers in it. And then I have a 2012, both Mazda. I just like Mazdas, but... Oh, and actually the funny, so my Mazda 3, going back to the technicians don't know what to do anymore. I actually had, right during COVID, I actually had one of my TCUs in the car died. It was, think of like your little cigarette lighter inside the dash.
Yeah.
Where you can go and charge it. That piece died, and I couldn't get the part because it wasn't being manufactured anymore because all the plants and stuff were shut down. And basically, there was no way to bypass that. And the engineers had no idea, or the technicians had no idea how to bypass that. And it effectively acted like a kill switch. So my car was basically stuck in their lot for almost 6 or 7 months until they figured out how to manufacture that part again. But I was essentially dead in the water. I couldn't bypass it. Nobody else could get a way to actually flip it. And so I can only imagine with even newer cars, right? It's the same deal where one little piece goes bad and they can't circumvent it. They can't change it. They can't modify that little piece that's telling the engine to shut off. And you're just kind of dead in the water. And it's really kind of crazy.
Is this planned obsolescence?
Oh, well, yes. To some extent, it's probably because they wanted me to upgrade, right?
Well, I fell for my own warning, unfortunately. I had a 2014 and I got it for almost nothing. It was a really nice car. And then there started to be trouble with the old turbo. Well, before we went into COVID, there was a little period where used cars became valuable. But then during COVID, so long story short, I traded it in for a newer car. During COVID, all of a sudden, magically, everyone can come pick up your car, right? So they drive to my house to pick up my car, to take it to go get an oil change. I'm not even kidding you. All of a sudden, this isn't everyone's budget. Everything's deliverable now. But the guy comes out and he says, man, I just traded in my car, which was a class below my car, and I got all this money. And I was incredulous. I'm like, no way. And so I get on the phone and I call. I say, how much for my car? And they tell me, like, I think it was almost 12 grand more than I paid for it.
Oh, yeah. They were going insane. Like, they were going like double. It was like, what?
That's where I fell into the trap. So, well, and, so then and it's I traded they had that
no inventory.
In.
Yeah, they had no inventory to sell. So they were desperate to just sell whatever they could find on the street. Yeah.
So I get a better car for almost nothing, literally almost nothing. As a matter of fact, it's worth more than I would ever pay for a car. I would never decide to pay that amount of money. So I traded in, and that's when I began to learn the lesson of modern cars and data collection. So what I was going to ask you is, have you taken any actions to change, even though you only have up to a 2016, so it's like right on the cusp of mass computerization and data collection. Did you do anything to change how you operate with your newer car?
So there's actually a couple things that you can do, and it's kind of fun, but some of it is kind of almost voiding the warranty, if you want to say. So there are some things that you can do. And a lot of it is like the biggest thing is, okay, you're connected to the internet. And again, depending on the manufacturer, what makes this difficult is every manufacturer is a little bit different. So in my mind, it's like, okay, I know that they're doing updates, or I know that they're sending my data somewhere. I don't quite know where they're sending it. They have some API endpoint somewhere that's receiving all this data. All the car brands are sending you different data. There's no standard of what the heck they're allowed to collect. And that's where you can use examples of like the data breaches, like the Toyota data breach. What was that? 2016, I want to say. That's usually where you can get some glimpse of what are they actually doing with my data, or what type of data they're collecting and what are they doing with it. And a lot of the times with that aspect, there was actually on the 2019 Toyota data breach, what makes this interesting was, again, it wasn't some crazy attack. It wasn't this, oh yeah, this guy hacked in from the internet or turned off all these cars. The breach actually occurred because essentially in 2014, Toyota introduced a navigation app called T-Connect. And when they put T-Connect out on their website, it's essentially just a smartphone app that connects your vehicle and enhances your driving experience and range of functions, right? All the blah-blah-y marketing stuff. But the big piece was that it allows for remote starting and control over your dashboard metrics. You could see all that stuff from your app, right? So think of it, the stuff that you would normally see in your dashboard, the big selling point was now you can see it from your mobile phone, because why not? So in 2017, right before the breach occurred, there was a subcontractor at Toyota that accidentally uploaded all of that source code for that app to a public Git repository. And it just sat there. And the problem with when they uploaded the source code on accident was inside of that source code, they actually had basically a hard-coded access key that anybody was allowed to use to interact with the server. So again, it wasn't this real elaborate hack. It was just some unfortunate soul uploading the wrong thing to the wrong location. And it just sat out there. And then it sat out there for years. Like, I don't think it was actually, they didn't find it until September 2022. So again, it was sitting out there publicly in 2017 until 2022. And then that's when they found this public repository. And that's when Toyota was like, oh man, we got to fix this. And then using that data, they figured out that they were basically collecting people's email addresses. They were collecting your customer management number with Toyota. They were collecting your name, your phone number, any credit card information that you had saved in the app, home address, all that other stuff. There's also a big piece where they sell a lot of that stuff to third parties, right? So think of like the telemetrics data, like, oh, I'm passing a Starbucks. Well, they're probably selling that to Starbucks, right? How often do you pass by this type of store or this type of one? All that stuff goes to all those parties. And the most frustrating piece is, again, you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what people are actually doing with it.
I have an addendum for what you just said. So check this out. If I was going to ask you off the top of your head, I'm going to read a little list so people actually have an idea. Your jaw will drop. Do you have any idea what car manufacturers in your mind would be the worst offenders?
I don't like to call out any of them. I think they're all bad.
So. Well, you're actually that is, you're absolutely right. Listen to this. According to certain sources, the worst offender is Nissan. Nissan admits that they collect a wide range of information, including sexual activity, health diagnosis data, genetic data, and they don't tell you how they're getting the data. They can share, sell, or give away any of it. Currently, the last analysis done claimed that the monetization of car collected data was a $750 billion business each year. Get this. Another top offender is Volkswagen, which collects demographic data like age and gender, driving behavior like seatbelts, braking habits, where your eyes are. Toyota has an incomprehensible galaxy of 12 privacy policy documents to hide what they're collecting. Mercedes-Benz also collects on your sex life. Again, not telling you how they get it, but here's where people have no idea. They're also collecting on the passenger. They're collecting the audio that goes on within the vehicle. And get this, any nearby pedestrians, which was put together by a PNI researcher, and Mozilla outed that they were doing that. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh yeah. No. And just imagine the next breach that occurs with any of these big ones, it's going to be massive, right? Because again, it's almost mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling just all the things they're collecting, all the stuff they're doing. So I do have some fun, I guess, risk reduction or kind of avoidance stuff that you can do for this stuff. So if you think of back in the day where a lot of the vehicles, again, I think of more like the luxury brands, like, you know, think of like the Mercedes, or essentially where back in the day, they used to have the 2G or 3G modem somewhere in the box or in the car. And what you could actually do was you can take it to the dealer and basically ask the dealer to disable the service and just disable that internet connection altogether. I'm hearing mixed signals where I think it depends a lot on the dealership, where it's probably not bad to try to ask. I would argue if the car's not doing over the air updates, there's probably a clause where, like, if it's over the air update, they probably say it'll void the warranty if they disable the internet. But hey, it's worth a shot if you really don't care about some of those features. The big caveat is, hey, the GPS isn't going to be working and all that stuff is probably going to be dead on your car anyway. But again, most people use their phone for that stuff. They don't necessarily use the built-in.
So you're talking about a hotspot, a mobile hotspot on your vehicle, right?
Well, a lot of them do. So for example, like I can think of like Volvo, where they actually have a SIM card in the back of the trunk where you can actually pop out. It's just like any other little SIM card for your phone. Or not a SIM card, the little cell phone chips, basically. You would just pop that out, put in your own, and at least it's not just some random number. I mean, it's still going to go over the same line, but you can also just pop it out entirely and, hey, guess what? The phone doesn't work anymore, you know?
See, I did that. I didn't think about getting a different... I did it on one of my vehicles, and then all the systems inside failed when you pulled that card.
Exactly, yeah. When you pull out that SIM card, it'll usually come back with like a fail and it'll say, oh, the infotainment can't work or this stuff can't work. And if you take it to the dealer, they can usually key that stuff away and just say like, okay, hide the error message or hide that stuff so that at least there's some functionality where you can always say the caveat like, oh, I just don't want to buy a new SIM card or I don't want to fix that part. I'll deal with it later. Just play dumb, right? And just see if they'll key it away and just let you drive off without any issues. There's another piece that you can do. Some people use, again, more of the luxury brands right now, they'll actually have like eSIMs, where it's even not the physical SIM card anymore. It's actually like the virtual card where you can go in and actually just deactivate that as well. So you could just turn that off just through the system somewhere.
It seems like they knew though, because when you pull it or you do something with it and it kills all other systems, it seems like they're actively trying to prevent you from doing that very thing.
Oh yeah. No, it's very much a game of what works and what doesn't and what can you get away with. And so there's another piece to it. Another trick that you can do is you can pull the fuses, right? So you typically have to look up your fuse diagram for your vehicle. And it's not like it's going to be one anymore. It's probably going to be four or five, or maybe even six, where you actually pull all those fuses and it'll kill the modem that way. But a warning on that is that does typically void the warranty. Like if you take it to the dealership and the fuses are pulled out, they'll be like, oh, what's going on here? That could void your warranty from there. But again, if you're out of warranty anyway, some people don't care. They just don't want to have any of that stuff being sent. The fuse diagrams though, themselves are pretty much, I think you can typically even find it just within your manufacturer's site. Whoever your manufacturer is for your vehicle, you'd call them or ask them to get a good diagram because you can't read the one in your manual in the book. But the other catch with this is they do call that, I think what you're talking about, Crow, is they call it limp mode, where it turns off a lot of the core functionality and it basically lets the car limp along to the dealership. Yep. So that they can fix it, right?
Yep.
And that basically reduces your engine power and until it's fixed or until the errors are keyed off by the dealer. But there is typically a way for the dealer to turn off limp mode, but they just have to be willing to do it. And again, that might be a good conversation with the gym.
Here's the thing though. Think about it. Whenever you have Wi-Fi, you pay for it, right? So I did a quick lookup. It's typical for any vehicle with a hotspot built in. You're going to pay about $20 to $40 a month. So the people who don't want to pay for that still have the ability, but it's, I guess it's not activated. But think about this. I did a quick lookup and you're right. All the like the Mercedes-Benz C-Class, the Audi 3, but now it's starting to go everywhere. Chevrolet Cruze, Malibu, Sonic Spark and Trax, Chrysler 200s, Dodge Dart, Audis, as I said, Toyota Camry, Corolla, Prius C, RAV4 and Yaris. I mean, it's going all the way down through the Volkswagens. I just did a quick lookup and what I'm getting at is a hotspot on board is becoming more and more commonplace with a fee attached to it.
Yep. Oh yeah. Anything to get that extra money coming out. So there's also a more, manual things you can do. This is really getting into it, but you can basically, instead of trying to disable the system, right? Which is usually what happens with those errors. you can actually go and, again, you have to figure out where your actual antennas are in the car, but oftentimes you can just unplug them. And again, you probably have to feel like, yeah, again, they could be buried in the door. They could be buried on the top of the roof or behind the dash where the driver's at. There's usually multiple antennas, but you can go and if you can figure out where they are, you just go in and plug all those antennas. And then it basically kills the signal and it won't actually, usually it doesn't typically trigger the same error messages that you've actually disabled the system. It's just that the antenna is not working. They actually have little, there's like, oh, what do they call them? Little dummy, it's like little dummy antennas, or it's like a dummy load that you can use to terminate that antenna connection. And if all else fails, you can also just cover those little antennas. You cover it with tinfoil or aluminum foil.
Where are they? The little antennas.
That's where, again, like I'm trying to think, like in my car, they were in the door frame. Like one is in the door jamb. Like you have to peel back that plastic or whatever that is in there. I'll have to find a picture. I'll send you guys a picture.
What's it called? Does it have a common name?
I just always think of it as it's just the antenna. I mean, it really is just like the little GSM antennas that are in the vehicle. And there's usually a couple that are used for that signal.
Because it seems to me like what you're talking about now would be the genius way. Just disable the antenna and the data's not going anywhere.
Right. If you do a lookup for like GSM antennas or just antennas in your vehicle, it'll usually have a diagram of where they're located. Because again, the engineers or the technicians will always need to go and find them too to troubleshoot some issues. So, or even third-party auto shops, right? So think of like if you're getting a new radio install, they usually have the same access to the data. And they're probably a little bit friendlier sometimes.
Could you use an EMF meter, like a trimeter, to zero in on them?
Yeah, you can try to find them that way too. But I still think usually the quickest way is just finding the diagram because it's all engineered out. So, and again, once you find it, you can also just put aluminum foil, just wrap the antenna in that too. And that also kills the signal. So it just can't get out. It'll say signal is lost. It won't say system failed or anything like that. It'll just say signal's lost and it can't actually go anywhere.
I actually am doing a quick lookup. I can't find anything on it. I must not be naming it properly because that's genius. You know, I was a radio guy in the Marine Corps. So disabling an antenna or putting a dummy one in is easy.
Yeah. I mean, it's the quickest thing to do, right? And you know right away if it's working.
Will that stop you from getting over the air updates and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, typically it'll, and again, it's kind of the same thing with the fuses, right? Where typically there's multiple antennas now. I mean, the most common one is usually, think of like where your steering wheel's at, you pull that back, whether it's plastic, whatever it is, there's usually one in there, but then you'll typically have some stuff like right above your sun visors. They could be in the sun visors. They could be up above like the top of your front window, could be along the back window. I mean, they just stick them all over. The funny thing with like just networking cable in a car, I mean, in most vehicles today, it's like 60 pounds of networking cable in them. So they're just sticking stuff everywhere, right? It's just
crazy.
It's just wherever they can cram it in, essentially. So it
makes you wonder what they're doing with all these cars that are slightly damaged. You know, it's to the point now where like if I got into a minor accident or even a decent accident in my car, I wouldn't notify my insurance company right away. I would make the decision, do I want to fix this or not? Because once they come in and total it, you're done. There's almost nothing you can do unless anyone listening knows any better. That's what I found. But we're coming up on the first hour here. Do you have a contact point that you want to give out to people? And this is hour one, Chris.
Yeah, I'll just put it into the comments, I think, at the end.
Okay, perfect.
Or an hour or two. Yeah, that's
yeah, that's a better bet. Jason, anything you want to get in before we wrap hour one?
Well, it seems like mostly we've been talking about conventional gas-powered vehicles. In hour two, I'd love to hear how much worse, or maybe not, that electric vehicles are.
Yeah, I would urge everybody out there to look up your, if you've got a vehicle that's maybe 2016 or newer, go look up the data that's being collected on you. It is insane. And if you have like a 2020 or newer, it'll blow your mind what's going on. I mean, it is data collecting at a level that I, if I had to guess, trumps every other aspect of your life, even when you're online. With that, we're going to bring hour one of episode 592.5 to a close. We're going to take a short break and come back and do hour two. We'll open up, as Jason said, with some of the electronic vehicles, which are like holy tech, even the drivetrains. But hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums. They can create new forums, new threads. They get access to all the comment sections, and they can stream Shoot the Moon, which is a two-hour film covering all my prior scope work, the lunar waves, and the first detection of the second sun. Also, membership gets exclusive access to my current work with my big honkin' solar telescope Yesterday, I filmed a real-time CME for the first time. That will be posted for members probably by the time this comes out. With that, I hope to see you all logged in as a member for hour two, and I would like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.